You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudet. It is Friday, time for our reporter roundtable. This is when we get you updated on news that made headlines around our region this week. Our panel today, Melissa Davlin with Idaho Public Television, Scott McIntosh with the Idaho Statesman, and Rachel Cohen with Boise State Public Radio News. Happy Friday, everybody.
Happy Friday.
Hello.
Happy Friday, Gemma.
Hey, oh, is that Eli? Did I just hear him,
Melissa? I was really hoping that you wouldn't be able to hear him, but he is definitely crying in another room right now. Dad's with him. Don't worry. He's fine.
Hey, listen, if you need to go get him, he can be our fourth panelist. Totally fine.
You know, you say that, but the screaming doesn't stop, Gemma. It doesn't.
Oh, I know. No. You know what? It doesn't stop even when they're 8 and 12 years old. So
that's good to know. I have a lot to look forward to.
Yeah. So there's that. All right. Let's actually talk about the news and not this, you know, work from home life. Melissa, let's start with the fact that there was actually an election this week. That was this week. Yeah. Tuesday. Still don't know the results though. But some fumbles, especially within the Secretary of State's office.
Right. So ballots have been available for request for several weeks now, but the deadline to request those ballots was 8 p.m. on Tuesday, which was election day. And you voters had an additional 2 weeks to get those in. So the deadline to return those is June 2nd, 8 p.m. local time. The problem was a number of people, as always, this was completely predictable, waited until the last minute to request their ballots. And that's perfectly legal, right? That's I have 100% been the person who waited until 7:45 at night on election day to go down to my polling place and cast my ballot. And so that is something that happened on Tuesday, but the Secretary of State's website went down. And a number of people said that they don't think that their request went through. That resulted in a lawsuit filed in U.S. federal court asking for that deadline to request people's ballots be extended because so many people had issues. You know, the problem with doing this online is you don't know who was waiting in line, who was having problems getting their ballot. It's not like when you're physically in person, as long as you're there and waiting in line by 8 o'clock, they let you cast your ballot. That you can't tell who had issues on Tuesday. And so there were also issues with, of course, voter information, protected voter information being released erroneously through public records requests. There are a small group of voters whose information is protected and because they're judges or because they have protection orders. And so while the vast majority of Idaho voters, their addresses and political affiliations and how many times they've voted is all available via public record through county clerks and the Secretary of State's office, something happened with the Secretary of State's software, and that information for about 55 voters was released to people who requested that information publicly. And that is sounds to be the issue, the topic of an investigation from House Judiciary and Rules Committee Chairman Greg Cheney. He sent a letter on Monday and made it clear that he's not happy with that misstep from the Secretary of State's office.
Right. And we should note that the Secretary of State's office has basically said, oopsie, it was a software error. But those protected addresses, they gave it out, I believe, to like 9 different organizations.
And one of those organizations, the Idaho Freedom Foundation, published that information on their website for anyone to download. And so while we know that 9 groups got that information, for those 9 groups, there's at least a paper trail, right?
Right.
But because the Freedom Foundation put that information out, that paper trail is gone. And so, you know, their defense was, well, this is public information. It doesn't matter that it's out there, which is true, but in a lot of ways, it's also less transparent than had people obtained that information through traditional means, because through those traditional means, it creates another public record. We know who got that information. We know who got the addresses of the judges and the people with protection orders. And it's, you know, obviously not a perfect system. There's nothing stopping me if I got that information from handing it off to somebody else, as we saw with what the Freedom Foundation did. But it's giving that information out as a private entity erases a lot of that transparency that mm-hmm. is built into the system in the first place. And so there are a lot of issues, and the blame is kind of falling on ideological lines, right? If people are in favor of vote by mail, they're saying, well, these problems are, you know, because of the Secretary of State and his office and the way that he is handling the office. If they're not fans of vote by mail, they're saying, well, it's the system that is messed up in the first place. And this is why vote by mail is problematic.
Yeah. And Gemma, let me add too, you know, this wasn't the first or second problem they had. There were problems earlier with voters getting the incorrect ballots. They had requested mm-hmm. Democratic ballots and gotten unaffiliated, nonpartisan ballots. And I think just kind of looking ahead, when you're talking about the November election, we might be in the same situation with polling places. And you know, there's already a call to do mail-in voting in November. And if they don't get these problems worked out, I think confidence in our ability to hold an election, which some might say the 2020 election is kind of a big deal in November.
Some might say that, yeah.
Yeah. So they really need to make sure they get these problems solved if we're going to have confidence in the voting system moving forward.
And this isn't, of course, solely an Idaho issue. We're seeing fights like this nationwide in all of these locales mm-hmm. that are relying on mail-in voting. It's become a national, very partisan and very ugly issue that in many places has ended up in the courts, and judges have decided different things depending on the issues in front of them.
Well, and we should note too that, I mean, our neighbors to the west, Oregon and Washington, have been voting by mail for quite a few years now. Their system seems to work fine. Their voters seem to like it. So yet on the flip side, here we have this lawsuit that was filed this week. And Melissa, they're asking, I believe, just for a 1 week extension of being able to get a ballot.
Right, exactly. And I should note that Idaho is one of, I believe, 34 states that has a no questions asked absentee ballot request availability, right? So I don't have to prove that I am, you know, serving overseas or that I am otherwise unable to vote in person. I, for any reason, can request an absentee ballot under normal circumstances, you know? So this is a system that we already had in place. It's just that the infrastructure wasn't ready for about 400,000 mm-hmm. requests. A lot of those came in the last week. I'll also note that with the partisanship, President Trump weighed in. And President Trump is somebody who has voted by mail. Those public records exist. And we know that he's utilized this in New York. So he attacked the swing states of Nevada and Michigan for having this setup, this vote by mail setup. And it's important to note that there are a number of Republican governors and secretaries of state, including Idaho, that had the exact same system, but because they're GOP strongholds, they didn't receive the same criticism as those swing states. And so looking ahead, we're kind of seeing this scary situation come at us in slow motion, where there are a lot of very prominent people, including our president, who are setting up potential challenges to mm-hmm. results that we see either with the primaries or in November, with this criticism that's being lobbed at the system before we even get the results.
Right. And he still votes by mail. Rachel, the governor is holding a news conference as we speak regarding testing. Can you talk about where Idaho is with testing for COVID-19?
Yes. So that press conference is going on right now, and we'll have some updates on that later. But I was able to get a brief snapshot of what they might be discussing today by tuning into the health department's board meeting yesterday, where they did kind of give an update as to where we are at. And the one of the first things that the testing task force did after they formed almost a month ago was really evaluate how much testing capacity we have in the state. They found that if all the labs in the state were operating at their maximum capacities, we could run 23,000 tests per week. That's a lot of tests. I mean, if you think about it, I think we've done just around 39,000 total. That doesn't necessarily take into account other challenges that will come along with that, like with supplies. You can have the lab space and the chemicals to run the tests, but you might still need the nasal swabs. So there are different components that will continue to be a challenge. Another important thing to point out is that currently, according to data from the COVID-19 tracking project, which is looking at case numbers and testing numbers and death rates across all states, Idaho has tested the fewest people per capita. That's fewest residents per 100,000 people in the state. And that's significant. There could be multiple reasons why that's the case. Our infection rates have been lower, so that could mean that there has been less demand here for testing than there has been in other places. But it also is perhaps an important indicator of where we are at, and that the fact that testing is a challenge for us and will likely be going forward.
And Scott, we have some non-coronavirus news, but also probably news that's not making people very happy. Property tax assessments are coming out, and they're higher this year.
Yeah, and I started thinking about this last month because I knew that the property tax assessment notices come out around Memorial Day for most people. And so I called Bob McQuaid, the Ada County assessor, last month, and he said, yeah, they're looking higher. Sales prices are trending about 10% higher. So at the time, he said, you can probably expect tax assessments to be 10% higher than they were last year. So if you had an assessment of $400,000 on your house last year, you could probably expect an assessment of $440,000 this year, depending on what neighborhood you lived in and the condition of your house. But what happened was in the ensuing weeks, and those assessments are based on last year's sales prices. So what the assessor's office does is they collect, they look at 12,000 to 13,000 actual real sales prices over the course of 2019. And they break it down by neighborhood. They have different zones throughout Ada County. And they determine, in your neighborhood, sales prices were up 12%. In this neighborhood, they were up 8%. But on average, overall, it was about 10% up. But then when they realized that, the coronavirus pandemic was affecting the economy, we had the stay-at-home orders that were affecting the economy, a group of folks got together, the Idaho Association of Counties, a few assessors, county commissioners, they got together, and in Ada County, they decided, well, let's increase assessments by about 5.5%. That will still keep us within range of where we're supposed to be based on 2019 sales prices, but it won't be as much of a hit as 10% would be. So people will be getting their tax assessment notices. This is not their tax bill. They'll get their tax bill later in the year in November, but this is their assessment upon which their tax bill in November will be based. But they'll get those assessment notices this weekend, and probably most people in Ada County in particular are going to see higher assessments.
Right. And then that goes back to the fact of, come November, will you be able to pay for it, right? With so many people out of work. So kind of a snowball effect there potentially, Scott.
Yeah. And I've written a couple times now that counties and cities need to be looking at their budgets, and they need to be taking this into account because they're going through their budgeting process right now. So that November tax bill is going to be based on the decisions that county commissioners and city council members are making right now on what they're going to set their budget at. And I've been suggesting that they should be looking at their budgets and cutting their budgets because if we're still in a little bit of a doldrum with the economy, it's going to be really difficult for folks to pay that tax bill, especially if it just keeps on going up another 10, 15, 20% like it's been doing over the past 4 or 5 years. So that those decisions are being made by city councils and county commissions right now.
Our panel, Melissa Davlin with Idaho Public Television, Scott McIntosh with Idaho Statesman, and Rachel Cohen with Boise State Public Radio News. Melissa, can you get us an update on the COVID-19 outbreak that happened on the Nez Perce Reservation and where we are now with that?
Absolutely. On May 1st, the Nez Perce Reservation reported its first COVID-19 positive test. And shortly after, they did some targeted testing with a family group that was connected to that positive test. And that number shot up to 17 positives in just a week and a half. And so the interesting thing about their testing strategy is that they began testing everybody who came into the Nimiipuu Health Clinic in Lapway. So asymptomatic individuals, people who had no known contact with people who had tested positive in the first place. It was a more aggressive testing strategy than we've seen in Idaho, where they are prioritizing, or until this week rather, have been prioritizing people who have been showing symptoms and people who are, you know, frontline workers pretty much, mm-hmm. right? And so with this aggressive testing strategy, they, of 132 tests, 17 people tested positive, including asymptomatic people. And so it helped them kind of understand that there was in fact community spread on the Nimiipuu Reservation that they wouldn't have known had they just been testing people who had been showing symptoms. They had 12% of those widespread tests, 12% came back positive, which is higher than we've seen in the state of Idaho as a whole. And it also shows, to go back to Rachel's point, if you don't test, you're not going to get a lot of positive results. I mean, that's just the math of it, right? And so the Nez Perce Reservation, like many of the tribal nation, the five federally recognized tribes in Idaho, they've had much more aggressive lockdown orders. They, before the governor implemented his emergency order back at the end of March, they had the Nez Perce Reservation had a curfew. They've been more aggressive about trying to contain COVID-19 on the Nez Perce Reservation in the first place this entire time. And so even though they did get a positive and they did have an outbreak and 12% positive test return, they've also been pretty good at trying to contain that. And with the residents in Lapway and Kamiai and Kuski, really understanding the need for social distancing and isolation.
Well, and it also goes back to the fact, Melissa, that asymptomatic people tested positive, right? And so unless you test asymptomatic people, I mean, you could have community spread and it could continue if these people never show symptoms.
That's exactly it. You know, Nimiipuu Health had the resources to test everybody who came to the clinic for whatever reason, even if it had nothing to do with COVID-19. And that's how they found asymptomatic people who tested positive. And so the press conference that's going on right now, and we'll hear details of that later. And in addition to your station, we're going to have details on tonight's Idaho Reports. But I'm very curious how they're going to address that, because again, we don't fully understand how this has been spreading through the community and affecting Idahoans, especially in rural areas mm-hmm. outside of the Treasure Valley, if we don't test asymptomatic people. I'm reading the Statesman right now and Nicole Foy's story that just came out this morning about how 23 employees at Right Stuff Foods in Jerome have tested positive for coronavirus to date. Rural Idaho is not immune to COVID-19. Right. And we take for granted here in Treasure Valley how easily accessible testing has been for us. We can drive to so many places and get testing, pretty much on demand at this point. There are still barriers to that, but the same is not true throughout the state. And you know, as a statewide program with Idaho Public Television, we've really been trying to stress that in Idaho Reports, that we cannot base our understanding of the disease based on the availability of testing just in Treasure Valley.
Right. And speaking of that, I mean, so Scott, Melissa just mentioned this outbreak in the Magic Valley, but also there was an outbreak at a food plant in Weezer. And talk to us a little bit about that, because that goes back to Melissa's point of these are rural communities. They are small towns, and then they are seeing these outbreaks.
Yeah. And really, you know, Weezer, this Fry Foods plant in Weezer was really the warning shot over the bow. This was the first warning sign, you know, and as we move back into going back to business and reopening our economy, this is so important. You've got 260 employees at this Fry Foods plant. Seven or eight people got coronavirus. And I would think that the state would have an interest in descending upon this community and test everyone in that plant, at least the 260 people who are potentially exposed to coronavirus, but they didn't. And the plant managers, they said, well, we don't know what to do. We're not given any direction. We're not, you know, being mandated to test. We're not getting any help to test. And you've got people, you've got some people who are uninsured. You've got some people who go to primary health. You've got some people who go to St. Al's, some people who go to private doctor. Some people are on Medicaid, some people are on Medicare. In Weezer, you've got people who live in Idaho and Oregon. Oregon has their own set of rules. It's just kind of a mess and there's no coordination. And fortunately, Crush the Curve Idaho saw this story that this small group of people had coronavirus and they descended on Fry Foods and they tested everybody and they found another 20 people with coronavirus that otherwise would have gone undetected. And if we're going to reopen our economy, and so what happened with Fry Foods is that they shut down because they didn't know who had coronavirus and who didn't. So they did the right thing and they shut down because they didn't want it to spread to another 260 people. But we can't just shut down every time somebody gets coronavirus because we don't have a vaccine. People are going to get coronavirus. And we can't shut down every time there's a small outbreak like the one we had in the paper today. In Jerome at the Right Stuff food product, same thing, very similar situation, small outbreak. And so we need a coordinated effort, I think, from the state to descend upon these places when we have an opportunity to test. I saw a tweet from Audrey Dutton just a couple minutes ago that the state is going to start testing asymptomatic people according to the CDC guidelines. And that's exactly what we need to do. So you test people who are negative, get them back to work, get things up and running, don't shut down the plant, get the economy going again. But that testing is just, that's the key thing that we have to do.
Mm-hmm. But two things about that. First of all, it is fantastic that we have Crush the Curve Idaho and the willingness of this private group to go out and take care of what the state didn't. But the fact that they are Treasure Valley centric and they are doing what they can for these rural communities. They visited Magic Valley. They've gone to other locales. But the fact that we have to rely on this private group to hit these rural communities when these public health districts, the seven public health districts that don't have a unified strategy and have totally different priorities across the board. Mm-hmm. That is problematic to me. The second thing is we are 2 months into this in Idaho. We were one of the last states to get positive confirmed tests, one of the last states to get fatalities, but we're still 2 months into this in Idaho. And they're just now talking about testing asymptomatic individuals. Mm-hmm. Again, if you don't test, you don't get positive cases. So I think that says a lot about our numbers.
Mm-hmm. Rachel, yeah. I'm curious. Yeah, go ahead, Rachel. I'm just curious because you're based in the Magic Valley.
Yes, and we have, the Magic Valley has actually seen some of the most cases in the past 2 weeks. But I did want to just jump in on what Melissa and Scott were saying is that, you know, the fragmentation of the public health districts, you know, and that starts really at the federal level, there's fragmentation on every level. That is revealing holes right now. So we can increase, we can say that our bottom line is we can test 23,000 people per week. That's great, but that's not across the board. That's not equivalent in each public health district. And so we're relying on a private organization, Crush the Curve, at the moment to come and swoop in and respond to in a minute's time. But we're also relying on private companies to secure tests on their own. You know, the Fry Foods Inc. tried to get their employees tested in nursing homes, long-term care facilities in the state. If they think they have an outbreak, they need to secure their own tests. And that was part of the problem we heard earlier about an outbreak at a Lewiston facility. They struggled to get tests for their residents until late April, but they were finally able to, and they could test everyone, asymptomatic people too. But in the meantime, before they were able to do that, you know, it was kind of like we're just sitting back with our hands up, waiting for these private facilities to figure it out on their own. And that is going to leave us with holes, because while some people might have the initiative to do that, it might be successful at doing that. It might not be the case for every situation.
Mm-hmm. Melissa, some news regarding the transgender inmate who was suing the state of Idaho for sex reassignment surgery. Can you get us updated on what the latest is on that?
Sorry, you should go to someone else.
Right now. Let's go to somebody else. Oh, poor guy. Hey, so Scott, let's talk about Governor Little's tweet recently that's gotten some buzz. And this was about local journalism right now, which I think a lot of journalists appreciated the sentiment.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. And I don't want to sound ungrateful. The backstory here is that there was a protest in Long Island, and a local TV news reporter from Long Island covered the protest. He went over to the protesters to talk to them and ask them why they were protesting. This was an anti-shutdown protest. And he recorded his interactions with these folks. And these folks were very abusive, verbally abusive. They were giving him the middle finger. They were swearing at him. They started up chants, fake news is not essential, calling him the virus, saying you're the virus, you're the enemy of the people. Is really, you know, kind of sickening when I saw it. And then unfortunately, the president retweeted it on Friday night and said, fake news is not essential. And, you know, that's kind of par for the course. Roll your eyes. Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. But then the president doubled down the next morning on Saturday morning and retweeted it again and said, people can't get enough of this, great people. So he's calling these people great people and, you know, really just encouraging it. And I guess that was enough for Governor Brad Little to send out a tweet of his own. Just, it wasn't a retweet, it was just a tweet saying, I support local journalists, they're doing a great job of informing the public, something to that effect. And that is great, and I appreciate that support. But I wrote a column that just kind of said, well, I appreciate the support, and I'm glad that you support local journalism, but that's really not enough to counterbalance what the leader of your party is doing. And really what we need is we need good people like Governor Brad Little and U.S. Senator Mike Crapo and Representative Mike Simpson to say, hey, come on, this is not the Republican Party. This is not who we represent. This is taking over the Republican Party and becoming the brand of this party, and we need to put a stop to it. And so I would prefer, I appreciate the governor's support for local journalism, especially since some local journalists, me included, have been critical of the governor for past actions, and I appreciate that he still supports local journalism. And but I feel like these leaders need to start calling out this behavior and say, this is not America. This is not the Republican Party. This is not who we are.
Well, and what's interesting to me about this, Scott, is that when we look at these people who are holding these anti-shutdown rallies, right, that are defying orders, and so many of them base it on their constitutional rights. Well, it is in the Constitution about the freedom of the press. And the fact that what we are doing as journalists and what we're being accused of doing is reporting what government officials and health officials are putting out there.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the freedom of the press, freedom of religion, freedom to assemble, these are all important rights that we have enshrined in the Constitution. And I don't mean to suggest for one second that journalists can't be criticized and we can't be challenged on some of the, but it's the way it's done. And I think this kind of aggressive, vulgar, really angry way, it is just going down a path that is frightening and dangerous and intimidating. And that's the part that I think we need to put an end to, stop this kind of vicious attack.
And when people are concerned about their rights being taken away, I mean, I think people need to think outside of themselves, right? And look at the fact that if you take the freedom of the press away, what else are you willing to take away? Because it will eventually have a trickle-down effect to you, whether you are a journalist or not.
Sure. And I think it's, and again, I think it's fair to criticize us, but do it in a way that doesn't have a chilling effect.
Yeah. Rachel, I'm really curious. You are based in the Magic Valley. You cover Sun Valley. As we know, not only were they a hotspot for coronavirus in Idaho, they were at one point, they had more cases per capita of COVID-19 than even New York City. I mean, it was bad. And they are also, though, you know, one of the biggest tourism areas in our state. And, you know, a lot of people think of Sun Valley in wintertime with skiing and all of that, but they have a big tourism economy in the summer. Do they have a plan for this? What are they expecting? You know, what's going on with that?
Yeah, summer is definitely big for Sun Valley. They have a lot of really big events, like the music festival. That's like the weekly orchestra series. And so it's a big deal. And I wouldn't say they have a specific plan, aside from the fact that all the businesses are, you know, trying to figure out how they're going to serve customers in this new environment. But they are kind of waiting to see who comes, who shows up, and they're making some predictions about maybe who's more likely to do that this year. I listened to a webinar from the marketing organization Visit Sun Valley, and they said that they thought maybe they'll see more younger crowds than is typical because those people might be perceive less risk from the virus. And another interesting thing is that people might be willing to drive much farther distances this summer because there's still a fear of air travel.
It will be interesting to see how I think these tourism areas are affected this summer, especially as people I think are getting cabin fever and want to go out and about. Melissa, I'd like to go back to you. Is everything okay? Little Eli doing all right?
If he isn't, he's in another room with Dad. So Dad'll figure it out.
You know what? This is the new normal, right? I mean, there is just no getting around it. So, hey, parents getting it done. Yeah,
it's
I know.
It's hard.
It is. It is. No, it is. Hey, you know what? My kids, I mean, I hear them fighting and running down the stairs, and I'm amazed that one of them doesn't come in here screaming yet, but it'll happen. It'll happen one of these days.
It will.
So it just will. It's inevitable. Yeah. Or there will be blood. I mean, something. Something will happen.
I'm not quite to that stage yet. You know, yeah. The kids are, you know, different enough in age. So, but I'll get there.
You will. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
so fine. you mentioned you have Idaho Reports tonight.
Yes.
And I really want to hear about this historian that you're bringing on, talking about, I mean, because so in 1918, there was the Spanish flu, and there's been so much talk about, you know, that pandemic, and here we are 100+ years later, and the similarities. So talk to us a little bit about what this historian has looked into.
there were so many more similarities between what happened a century ago and what's happening today. Tara Rowe is a Nampa historian and writer, and is also politically active. And so she was really able to talk about not just the basics, like the spread of the virus, but also really talk about some of the contemporary issues that Idaho saw during the outbreak, including an intense skepticism of how serious the virus was at the beginning of it, some of the xenophobia that was associated, the whole reason it was called the Spanish flu in the first place, right. And she was able to talk about the public health measures that the different localities and the state of Idaho implemented to try and, you know, we call it social distancing now, but it was the same thing 100 years ago. And she talked about the long-term effects that the pandemic had that we still see today, 100 years later. Just to give you a preview, the whole reason that Idaho State University has a nursing school is because of that pandemic, the ripple effects of trying to train up nurses in the aftermath of both World War I and this outbreak. And so hearing about how this flu affected both rural and urban Idaho, it was so eerie, right? Because I knew that there were parallels going into this, but having Tara weave together this picture for us was really eye-opening. And so we'll have that tonight on Idaho Reports. It airs at 8 p.m. on Idaho Public Television.
I want to thank all of you for taking some time out of your day to be a part of the roundtable. It's Friday. It's Memorial Day weekend. I hope you guys are at least, you know, take a breather. Melissa, it will all pass. They will grow up. But
we'll make it.
I know. Then they'll hit each other and stuff like that. So, you know, I mean, you're gonna be a
lot to look forward to.
Thanks, you guys. We've been talking with Melissa Davlin, Scott McIntosh, and Rachel Cohen, our Friday Reporter Roundtable. Appreciate your time, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
More Idaho Matters next.